First argued case is Ironburg Inventions v. Valve Corporation, 2021-2296. Ms. Israel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. So, subject to the Court's questions, I plan to address two primary issues in the limited time that I have. Well, it looks like Judge Clevenger may have a question already. I plan to address the District Court's error in failing to find the asserted claims invalid as indefinite, and also the District Court's error in denying the motion for judgment as a matter of law, where there was not substantial evidence to support the jury's verdict of infringement. First, I think it's helpful just to keep in mind the claim limitation that's at issue here. It recites each back control, including an elongate member. So it just says that the member has to be elongate, that it extends substantially the full distance between the top edge and the bottom edge, and that it's inherently resilient and flexible.
Ms. Israel, when I look at the language that you're talking about and the drawings in the patent, seems to me they're fairly definite. And if I had any doubt here, I would wonder about infringement. But infringement is a question of fact, and you had a jury verdict here. That seems to me to be the hill you have to climb.
Well, let me see first if I can tell you why the claims are indefinite, and then I will turn to the infringement issue. So first, the claim in this patent specification, you've got one example. You've got one example of what would correspond to an elongate member, and that's the one example in the spec is the so-called. You've got these paddles that are elongate in shape. They're at column 3, lines 51 to 56 of the patent, and shown in figures 2 and 3. So basically those kind of popsicle stick-looking controls that are on the back. And beyond that, you've got in the file history, you have the Ogata. There was the applicant's distinguished over Ogata at appendix 1728. And Ogata discusses a rotation actuator, and it includes an ellipsoidally shaped head. And that's, you can see the Ogata reference in that discussion at appendix 2506.
Which aspect of the limitation are we talking about now? Are we talking about elongate?
So I'm starting with the elongate.
Or about the measurement feature?
Yeah, I'm starting with the elongate, but I will go to the measurement feature in just a minute. So
then, what's your response to Judge Lurie's, the presiding judge's observation, the drawings alone suffice to eradicate any indefiniteness concern?
Well, we would disagree. This is a case where you've got one example, like the interval license.
But look at the drawings. I think the presiding judge said in his view he thought the drawings doomed your challenge. Do you understand him to say that?
I did, yes.
Then what's your response?
That the
drawings show, I guess we're looking at figure 2, and figure 3 are the only figures that, and yes, in the very beginning, it's figures 2 and 3, right?
Right.
That show this long thing looks like a little long hot dog, right?
It looks like a little long hot dog, and then
would you agree that by anyone's definition of the term elongate, those two little hot dogs are elongate?
Those two hot dogs, based on it being
used.
Are
the hot dogs elongate, yes or no?
A hot dogs would be elongate.
Well, I think that's probably what Judge Lurie had in mind.
Okay.
So is a patent is a drawing and a non-design patent sufficient evidence to show definiteness? This is not a design patent case.
It's not a design patent case. And I think what happened here is the issue is it is a term, elongate though is a term of degree. And so the question isn't, a hot dog would be elongate. The question is does a zone of uncertainty as to what is not elongate? And that's where there needed to be some guidance given. There was not reasonable certainty as to objective guidance as to what that term of degree means, how far it extends. So a hot dog may be elongate. So what we know from the specification is you've got those paddles shown in figure two that are elongate, and then we know the Ogata actuator is not. And we don't know what in between is or is not.
The prior art reference that you're talking about that was in the IPR was a little button, right? Round?
It was, although it's more of a, I think it's closer to actually a joystick actuator.
On the aspect of the limitation that Neil's calling for the measurement, substantially the full distance between A and B. So where in the patent is the would-be infringer told how you know what the top edge is and what the bottom edge is?
Thank you for asking that question, Judge Clevenger. I think that you hit on a question that illustrates why we think that part of the term is indefinite. It doesn't.
You have to know where the top edge is and the bottom edge is, right?
You have to know where the top edge is and the bottom edge is. And depending on where you pick a top edge and a bottom edge, unless you know how to measure that, unless you know how to measure what the full distance is,
If you know what the top edge is and the bottom edge is, you know how to measure the full distance.
With
a yardstick or ruler.
Correct.
So you can measure it, and then after you measure, you're going to have to deal with the question of whether or not it is substantially. You know, when that substantially word shows up in lots and lots of patents. So my only question is, how do you know where the top and the bottom is? The written description tells you where the top is. The top is where the buttons are on top. And you look at figure one. Right?
Right.
So they tell you they don't ever tell you where the bottom is.
That's correct.
You have this device that's shaped like this, roughly the same way. So is the bottom somewhere in here, or is it over here?
It depends on, it's not clear.
I mean, why do we have to know where the top and the bottom are? Isn't it sufficient for a person of ordinary skill in the art to know that the device can be used for the purpose it was designed and claimed for? That is, just like the elongate member, if people with different size hands can use at least one of their fingers to operate that back paddle or button, then it extends sufficiently or substantially the full distance between whatever the top and the bottom is. What in this record clearly and convincingly holds to the contrary?
So, well, you can look at the declaration of Mr. Desmelic that was submitted in the claim construction and indefiniteness briefing.
There was a competing declaration from the plaintiff, correct?
Not at that stage. No, not okay. In the claim construction stage. His declaration is at appendix 3921-24.
And so was there only defense expert testimony in the record at the claim construction stage?
Yes, that's my understanding, Your Honor.
And so do we have a subsidiary factual finding with respect to indefiniteness that we review for clear error?
There was no finding made on that. In fact, if you look at Appendix 14, there's a footnote from the order there where the court, footnote 5, where the court actually said that there had been a motion to strike Mr. Desmelic's declaration, and the case had been transferred, and the court struck it regarding its, it struck the plaintiff's motion as moot and didn't consider the declaration.
Let me ask you this. You spent a lot of time in the briefing on the full distance basis for indefiniteness, but the term that you actually asked the district court to invalidate as indefinite is the extends substantially the full distance between the top and the bottom edge. You never specifically asked just that full distance itself be construed as indefinite. Is that correct?
Well, we were focusing on the full limitation, and I think where the issue comes really where the rubber meets the road is really what does full distance mean in terms of how do you make that measurement? So how do you understand the substantially?
It seems like the district court only clearly addressed the substantially portion of the claim term and didn't clearly address the full distance. Would you agree with that?
Well, the district court did say that what the court said was it means that the full distance between the, it means largely but not necessarily entirely the distance between the top and bottom edges. But then it didn't address how to measure that, and it ignored the evidence that was in the record.
And did indefiniteness ever come up again at any point in the case in the district court?
Well, yes. Valve continued to argue the term was indefinite. You can see that at Appendix 3892.
Which page?
3892.
But did you ever push the district court for a finding on where the top and the bottom are and how to measure the full distance?
Oh, we did that to the extent that we did it in the claim construction briefing, we presented the declaration of Mr. Dismelik that the district court ignored.
If you feel the district court ignored the issue you put in front of it and the evidence you put in front of it, did the issue just die there or did it ever come up again?
I'm not aware that the issue was renewed after that.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time. You can save it or continue as you wish.
Let me take one minute. So first, by failing to resolve issue of claim construction, the district court further erred by submitting an issue on that should have, where the court should have made a construction to the jury under O2 Micro. Let me also address the issue of the the issue of infringement. There was no substantial evidence to support the verdict that the alleged elongated
memory. I just ask you this on infringement. Without objection, it seems you all put the accused device in the hands of all the jurors, and your own side argued this is a simple technology. All you need is the patent and the device that's in your hands. Doesn't look like anyone asked the jury be instructed. Don't rely on your own sense impression of the device we put in your hands. When you argue, here's the device, play with it yourself and decide infringement, and then you don't like the outcome, how could that not be substantial evidence?
It doesn't support, the device itself, the controller itself, and the evidence that was in the record supports that what Ironburg referred to as the elongate members had these ribs behind the ends that were rigid and did not flex. They took the exact opposite position that they took in the inter-parties review proceeding with respect to what this term means, because the term requires that the elongate member itself has to be able to be bent or flexed by a load. And there's nothing in the record to support that. What the evidence supports is that the ribs were added to prevent flexing, to prevent bending and flexing. And moreover, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal to the extent I have any left.
We'll give you 2 minutes back for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Tamkin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I think during Ms. Israel's argument, the Court addressed the major issues. And I want to pick up on some of those, but I want to start by just saying something that we all, I think, acknowledge. This is a simple patent. As Judge Stark indicated, the jury was able to look at the patent, look at the instructions on claim construction, and ultimately hold the product in its hand. Because this was an interesting case. This was one of the first cases that was tried over Zoom. It was, and so as a result, all of the jurors actually received an alleged to be infringing product. They were able to hold it in their hand during the closing arguments, during their deliberations, presumably, as well.
They got to figure out for themselves what the top is and what the bottom is.
That's exactly right. And the reality is,
let me just ask you this. If you were sitting in the jury box or in the jury room and you were talking about where's the top and the bottom, and somebody said, well, let's look at the patent. The patent will tell us. Patents always tell you clearly what the meets and bounds of the invention is.
Well, sure.
When you point to me in the patent where I would learn where the top and the bottom is? Well,
certainly the top edge is referenced in the specification.
Well, the top edge is the word in the claim, right?
Correct.
So top edge is referenced because they say that's the place where in the patented things buttons are on the top of it.
Right.
So where's the bottom?
The bottom, as the patent describes, the bottom is the opposite of the top, if you will. And that's sort of common English, which is if the top's up here, the bottom's down here. It's all for orientation purposes. And
just looking at this device, the bottom could be either here or here or someplace in between?
That would be up to the jury.
Somewhere in between.
But the question is not what is the top
edge? How did the jury get guided by the patent?
Well, the jury can look at the descriptions in the patent and can look at the drawings in the patent. And the drawings indicate where the top was, and then certainly would indicate where the bottom edge is.
The drawings indicate that the bottom could be anywhere on a line like this.
Correct. The bottom could be anywhere on the line like this. And the bottom could change based on configuration of a controller is. You can have a controller, for example, that would be perfectly rectangular with no change on the bottom, and that would be it'd be very clear where the bottom edge is. But certainly the bottom edge is the opposite of the top edge, which was described. And so I think
I forgot to look. Did your firm try this case?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, somebody else.
Indefiniteness was decided at the claim construction stage, correct?
No, Your Honor. It was actually, there was a second motion on indefiniteness, and that's where indefiniteness was decided.
Are you talking about the judgment as a matter of law motion?
No, there was a second motion on indefiniteness. The judge...
Yeah, if you can get me an appendix site for that.
We will, okay. While I'm doing that. I think one of the things that Your Honor raised was what was decided down below, what was the arguments with respect to indefiniteness. And at Appendix 11 in the judge's order, the judge made clear what the judge was deciding on indefiniteness. And particularly, the judge was looking at what does substantially mean and understood that's what the parties were arguing about.
But it seems pretty clear from the brief excerpts that you gave us that the defendant was also arguing that you couldn't tell where the top and the bottom edge were, and so you couldn't tell what the full distance was. Didn't they argue that?
They argued that to the jury, but they did not argue that necessarily to the judge.
I think it's in their claim construction briefing as well, they say that you overlooked that argument, and now they say the district court overlooked that argument as well.
I don't think that was in certainly as part of the claim construction briefs.
And if you can tell me where the district court ruled on that argument, that would be helpful as well.
I think the district court ruled on indefiniteness at Appendix 11 on the substantially portion. And that's where the judge...
And that does not include a discussion of top and bottom.
It does not directly include a discussion.
It doesn't include some of it.
Well, it discusses the overall term and says this is what the term is. And then it says, and what Valve has argued, what the appellant has argued to the district court was... what does substantially mean? And then the court ruled on that. The court, I agreed.
Is there a possibility that the district court didn't rule on a piece of it that Val was asking to have ruling on?
I think you can make the argument that the district court didn't rule on the piece of that Val is arguing now, but that's not necessarily what Val was.
I thought there was something in their claim construction briefs about top and bottom and measuring.
In their claim construction briefs in terms of how to interpret the claim, yes. But on the in the supplemental brief regarding indefiniteness, which is Appendix 3873, Judge Stark, that was the second issue, and that was what was ultimately resolved in that.
That's supplemental briefing on the motion that follows claim construction, you're saying?
I think so.
And those, that's not in our appendix, those briefs?
I think it is, but I'm not certain. So going back to the issue that Judge Clevenger raised, you have a top, you have a bottom, and the bottom was understood to be the opposite of the top. What you're trying to do in claim construction, of course, as Your Honor is aware, is determine from the patent, as Your Honor has asked, what are these issues? It's not the question of, when I look at the accused product, do I use that to help interpret the patent? No. You look at the patent itself. In the patent, there's a top edge. The bottom is the opposite of the top edge. That was really all that was needed. And the question of then, is there infringement, is a question for the jury. As Judge Stark raised, if you have a top...
Well, we have case law on problems that get created when you end up with claims that require measurements. And two of those cases were cited against you by your adversary, and you didn't respond to them. Dow, and then another case. I just was curious. I mean, we do have case law in the indefiniteness area that deals with claims that require measurements. And the question is, does the POSA know which measurement to use?
If you look at all of those cases, Your Honor, like the Dow case, or I think it's either the Tiva or Takata case.
Yeah, it is. Well, both those cases were cited front and center by your adversary in their brief, and you didn't respond to them, which suggested to me that you thought maybe they were hard for you to overcome.
I don't think they're hard to overcome. They're just inapplicable.
You didn't even say they were inapt. You just didn't mention them.
I apologize. I'll say it now. I don't think they're applicable. The reason I don't think they're applicable is because those are cases where there was a measurement that was ambiguous or unclear based on the patent itself. Here, there's no issue with respect to how to measure.
So you agree that a claim that's calling for measurements can produce an indefiniteness question?
I would have to agree with that, Your
question
Honor. That's
then
what those
would
cases
be whether
said.
This case were, and our judgment whether this case falls within those two cases that we're talking about or outside of them.
Sure. That being said, the reality is here, this is a simple measurement. This isn't measurement molecular weight or measuring across a tiny particle where scientists try to determine how one measures this.
Well, it's a simple thing, but when you try to figure out where the flex is, if there is any flex, it's not easy.
Well, it actually is easy in this case because that back panel snaps off and the jury is able to press right on it. For the flex point, Your Honor. There's a little button right on there that
when you take it apart,
you press a little button back there and the back panel comes off. And the jury had that in their hands, Your Honor. And the jury was able to press on the elongated member and make a determination as to whether or not it flexes.
I don't understand how the jury could have done that if they were participating by Zoom.
Thank you, Your Honor, I was unclear. So each of the jurors who was participating by Zoom was sent one of these actual devices. So they had it in their hands. They weren't looking at photographs. They weren't looking at just pictures. Obviously, they were in terms of...
Is there a tape in this video hearing?
I'm sorry?
Is there, on the Zoom, is there a tape of all that? Is all that recorded someplace? Could I, for example, look, were the jurors seen on the Zoom doing this?
I don't know if there's a recording of it that's been kept or not. There's certainly a transcript that we've all seen. But certainly the jurors had this in their hand to do whatever it is that they were going to do. There certainly was a description in the trial transcripts of people putting displays and pictures and slides on the screen that would show some of these things as well.
And so in the argument, I assume now that I'm beginning to get it, is that the elongate member is in this device embedded, which the claim allows it to be, in the infrastructure.
Right. And, well, the,
and the elongate member is not anywhere on this.
Well, the elongate members, when this, the, when the device is in one's hand and it's put together, the elongate member is this area over here.
Counsel, do you want to address your cross appeal?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor. Turning to the cross appeal, just like I think that the infringement issues are a jury question, which all, we all understand and need to be honored, the jury's verdict in this case also needs to be honored. Here there was a situation where the jury decided, based on the jury instructions, based on the SRI case that we're required to follow, that you follow the jury and the jury made this ruling. That ruling, in particular, I want to get it so I can read it, was that defendant engaged in additional conduct manifesting deliberate or reckless disregard of plaintiff's patent rights. In that case, in order to find that, the jury had to find two different things. They had to find that there was intentional copying, and they had to find that there was an unreasonable risk of infringement. They had to find one of those two things to find that there was willfulness. And here, there was a jury finding that there was willfulness. So then we get to, what did the judge do with that? The judge was required to follow the HALO decision. And the HALO decision says you no longer look at objective recklessness. You look at specifically the subjective intent of what was going on. And I think in this case, that's what the judge didn't do. The judge didn't look at the focus on the subjective intent, but really focused, were there reasonable defenses? Really operated under the old Seagate case.
Can I ask you a question about willfulness? Because there's a dispute over whether the district court erred in denying the judgment as a matter of law of no willfulness as moot. I'm unclear on how that could be moot, in part because it created a basis for you to file your motion for enhanced damages. They say they shouldn't have to live in this world as an adjudicated willful infringer. Maybe there'll be bankruptcy consequences. Didn't the district court have an obligation to assess the sufficiency of the evidence?
Well, I think I would have preferred the district court to have done that, but I understand why the judge didn't. The judge said, I'm going to use my discretion. Answer the second question first. You answered the question on enhanced damages, which is the only thing that...
But did he have discretion to just deny their challenge to willfulness as moot?
I think otherwise it would be moot, yes. I mean, their claim that there's a theoretical question as to how a willfulness finding could come about is a pure theoretical question. And so you're asking the judge to answer a theoretical question that wouldn't
be answered. They say, for instance, I think that there could be bankruptcy consequences, whether it's dischargeable or not. Why is that theoretical?
Because it is theoretical, because there was no bankruptcy. And so at this point, it is a theoretical question, and that's all that it is. And so,
you mean in order to make it live, they actually have to be in bankruptcy?
No, I think in order to, I think they.
It's a sort of a declaratory judgment test for Article III standing. Is that where you're taking it?
I think it probably is in the reality here, because here there's a question of willfulness. It was answered. The judge determined that he did not need to look at the question any further.
Doesn't being branded as a willful infringer have consequences even beyond bankruptcy?
I don't know what those consequences are.
You wouldn't want to be branded that. Your client wouldn't want to be so branded, right?
I don't know what the consequences are other than a finding of no willfulness. Enhancement.
On your motion, didn't the district court judge in denying the request for enhanced damages say that this, in its judgment at least, this is a garden variety case?
And that's why I think the district court judge ignored the HALO decision, because he looked at the defenses. He looked at, well, they only...
Is that a fact-finding when he says it's a garden variety case? What? It seemed to me that if the judge is saying it's a garden variety case, he's also saying that it probably wasn't willful infringement.
I think what it does is it tells us that the judge is looking at the defenses, and he's looking at claim.
Was it, when he said that, was that a fact finding or observation or exhortation?
I think it was an observation on the overall way that the case was tried and it was presented, and a comment on the defenses. And
before you sit, if I might, on estoppel, we have a bunch of disputes about estoppel. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about the estoppel of the late discovered grounds as opposed to the non-instituted grounds. It seems like there is a fact dispute over whether that third party found those references through ordinary diligence or not. And the district court put the burden of proving that on Valve as the party challenging, as opposed to on you as the party proposing estoppel. Shouldn't the burden be on the party that's making the affirmative defense? And if we think that's where the burden should be, what do we do? Do we just have to remand for further fact proceedings?
I think in this case, the judge looked at, did the party seeking to apply estoppel, did they come forward with evidence such that it required Valve to rebut that evidence? And there was evidence, and the judge found that there was evidence, that evidence being there was an expert declaration who said these were findable, and then there was certainly all of the evidence that was put before the PTAB in the IPR. And so ultimately the judge looked at that evidence and said, what did Valve come back with? And Valve didn't come back with anything. Came back with three declarations from the IPR that it had lost on. And in particular, it came back with these declarations that, number one, what it did, well, I guess it was originally was the Ironberg declaration saying, these were findable.
Do you think the district court made a fact finding as to what a reasonably diligent searcher for prior art could find?
I think it did, Your Honor. It said.
And how was he permitted to do that without having a trial?
I think it was based on the evidence presented that and this is an estoppel issue. It's a judge decided issue. The judge took that evidence and there was facts that the judge considered. And based on those facts, the judge made a ruling. There's no requirement that there be an evidentiary hearing. There would be no additional information for there to be an evidentiary hearing on, and I don't think there was clear error in this case.
Counsel, your time has expired, but we will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, as you had requested, if on your cross-appeal, if there is something we will hear to rebut.
Understood, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Israel will give you 4 minutes. Since Mr. Tamkin has had extra time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So first, to address the last, Judge Stark's last question on IPR estoppel, I think we have a different view of the evidence that was in the record. My understanding is that Valve put into the record evidence of what it had done in terms of what Valve's reasonable search was. And there were, I believe, four declarations and additional information showing how, what Valve had done. What Ironberg had included was evidence of a third party had found the same references at a later time. But they did not make any attempt to show what a skilled searcher exercising reasonable diligence would be expected to discover.
Your adversary said that there were two pieces of information that they put in an expert declaration saying that these three references were findable. That's what I understood your adversary to say.
My understanding of what they were referring to was a declaration that they had used in the IPR in a previous terminated IPR proceeding to show why another reference, this at Appendix 7387. I misspoke. They did have a declaration on Appendix 7387, although that declaration of Mr. Kitchen didn't apply the skilled searcher standard. I think what it did is just went through the list of the different references and discussed those references briefly, but not.
Who has the burden of proof on this issue? Have we ever addressed that?
This court has not addressed it. The burden of proof should be on the party asserting estoppel, just like any other estoppel doctrine.
Is it a burden of proof we're talking about, or a burden of going forward with the evidence? This case, your adversary put in some evidence, and they said, "Hey, these three references have been found. They're obviously available." And then, as I understood, the district court was then shifting the burden of going forward to you to say you better rebut that or else you're going to lose.
So, well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that the parties agreed, nobody disputed that the standard the court was applying was the skilled searcher standard. What a skilled searcher exercising reasonable diligence.
I'm just being technical. We're talking right. Burden of proof.
Okay.
The burden of proof lies on the challenger here for right through to the end. But I understood this to be a case of whether or not the burden shifted. The burden of coming forward with evidence shifted to you.
I think the burden of proof would still remain with the party who is trying to assert the doctrine of estoppel.
And your argument would be the burden should never shift to you under any circumstance.
That's correct.
Judge Stark asked the question of your adversary, and I didn't get an answer from him, is what do we do if we decide that there was an error here in the shifting of whether it's the burden of proof or the burden of coming forward with evidence to you was error? Well, what do we do? Do we have to send it back, or can we determine that there is sufficient evidence here of one form or another that means that the error is harmless?
I think you would have to go back. The court effectively treated the motion for IPR estoppel as a summary judgment motion and effectively found there was no genuine issue of material fact. However, it never even addressed the evidence that Valve had presented. That's at appendix 8457 to, I think I have it written down incorrectly, but there's
your evidence, you didn't put any evidence in as to the quality of the search conducted by the other party who found the references.
Nobody put in any evidence on that.
That's the only question that's up for grabs on this whole issue. Because the question is, there are these three prior references that were found in another IPR. If they were found as a result of extraordinary efforts, then they would not be estoppable. But if they were found as a result of ordinary diligence, then you would be estopped.
So on that issue, as to how you would prove what a skilled searcher exercising reasonable diligence would be expected to discover, then neither party put in any evidence on what would be reasonable in terms of what the collective minds party found and what search that they did and whether it was reasonable.
But isn't that the question?
There was evidence in, I don't.
If these other three prior art references that were found in another IPR, right, if they were found as a result of ordinary diligence, right, then they'd be estoppable.
Well, those were found, but the IPR, that IPR was initiated, I believe, after the Valve's IPRs were already concluded. So it was at a different time frame.
But you never argued that those references were totally irrelevant for that reason.
We didn't. Not that they were irrelevant for that reason, but we did put, there was evidence, I guess, in the record, again, that the court just never even considered to determine whether
standard. Thank you, counsel. I think we have your argument, and your time has expired. And since there was nothing on the cross-appeal issue, Mr. Hampton, I think we have nothing further to hear from you. Thank you both. Case is submitted.